Okay, so today we'll be talking about cancer cell metabolism. So this is one of the slides from the previous lectures, if you remember. So I mentioned the last time that we will be touching upon some of these aspects. So this is was added as a update from the Hanan's old review, the hallmarks of cancer. So some of the new things during the past few years is one of them is avoiding the immune destruction, tumor promoting inflammation, cancer genome instability, deregulating cellular energetics. So this is the part of the this is the focus of today's lecture. Why is the cellular energetics important in the cancer process? How does the various signaling pathways we touched upon last week impinge on the regulating cellular energetics? What is usually happens in the cytoplasm and in the mitochondria, and vice versa. And you would see some interesting situations where what is happening in the mitochondria can impact the gene expression machinery within the nucleus. So it's a two-way traffic between the mitochondria and the nucleus. So what is metabolism? It's a collection of controlled intracellular biochemical reactions that convert nutrients and endogenous molecules to energy and matter. So metabolism deals with not only energetics, but also the raw materials for cells themselves. Like cells are constituted of, as you know, proteins, nucleic acids, and lipids that sustain life. So metabolism deals with both those processes. Energy for living cells to do whatever they are supposed to do, and also the matter of which they are made of. A sequence of chemical reactions where the product of one reaction serves as a substrate for the next, and it's called a metabolic pathway of biochemical pathway. The set of reactions occurring within the cell are called intermediary metabolism or intermediate metabolism, because one intermediate becomes the substrate of the next step. So that's how the term comes. Most metabolic pathways take place in specific regions of the cell. So some of these aspects you already know from your undergraduate courses in biochemistry. So the purpose of this lecture is not to go into too much detail about the various steps in the major processes like glycolysis and TCA cycle, but oxidative phosphorylation, because the assumption is that you know the basics of it from your undergraduate studies. We will be touching on some of the specific steps or specific enzymes to illustrate certain principles, but the details of the sequence of those pathways, I assume you know, and if you want to refresh, you should go back to your old biochemistry notebook or any textbooks in the library. General biochemistry textbooks will give you that. And as I told you, I'm not going to quiz you on all the details of all the steps in those metabolic pathways. The idea here, the purpose of this lecture is to illustrate how the metabolic process itself is important in the cancer process. So that's how an electronic circuit version of metabolic pathways. This is a book which are familiar to most of you by the famous author Albert Leninger, Principles of Biochemistry, the 5th edition. So he just put this to illustrate the complexity of this. Just as we saw last lecture, the complexity of signaling. This is a metabolic signaling, if you may, how complex it is with the different dots, nodes, and connections, all interconnected in many ways. And so metabolism consists of two major aspects. One is components, catabolism and anabolism. Catabolic pathways, the purpose of there is to break down larger molecules into smaller products. And they are usually, they produce energy, or they are called exergonic processes. And anabolic pathways, on the other hand, synthesize large molecules from smaller products of catabolism, endergonic, and they require more energy than they release. So the production of ATP, for example, is a catabolic process, whereas the synthesis of proteins or nucleic acids or fats are considered anabolic pathways. So that's illustrated here. So catabolism, so in the previous slide, the stored energy is in the catabolic process, ATP is used up, and it is channeled to the anabolism, and where the energy is lost as heat. Some of the energy in both processes are lost as heat. And some of these precursor molecules here contribute to the catabolism and then in turn to the anabolism. So ADP gets converted to ATP during the catabolic process and vice versa. And because ADP, as you will see, is ATP is one of the major currencies, energy currencies of cells. And then from larger building blocks, macromolecules such as carbohydrates, lipids, etc., which are needed for various processes such as cell growth, cell division, etc., and also cellular structures such as cell membranes, ribosomes. So all these are interlinked. Now cell energy, ATP is the main energy currency of the cell. Formation of ATP, degradation of glucose and glycogen, that process is called glycolysis. And also from oxidative formation of ATP in the presence of oxygen, it's called oxidative phosphorylation. And anaerobic pathways, they do not involve oxygen, and an example is glycolysis. Aerobic pathways, they require oxygen, example oxidative phosphorylation. So this again is giving you an overview of the various steps involved here. Please remember that this is not an exhaustive sequence of all the events in the metabolism. As the Leninger's diagram showed, this is an oversimplification just to illustrate some of the major connections. So starting from with the glucose undergoes various steps in this metabolism, and it ends up in pyruvate. Pyruvate has two fates. Either it can channel to the mitochondria, where it becomes a substrate for the TCS cycle through various intermediates, and then it is linked to the oxidative phosphorylation machinery where most of the ATP is produced, or it can lead to lactate, and that's the glycolysis part. So there are various processes and pathways linked to that. This is another pathway where it is, this pathway leads to nucleotide synthesis, for example, and this is interconnected by what is called a phosphate, pentose phosphate shunt, and then glycolysis is also can lead to amino acid synthesis, which in turn can also contribute to nucleotide synthesis. There are multiple steps in each of these arrows, which are not shown here to simplify this, to give you an overall concept here. And acetyl-CoA, which is one of the substrates for the TCS cycle, is also a substrate for the anabolic process of lipid synthesis. And here, some of these you saw in the previous lecture, growth factor stimulation, and the tyrosine kinase sitting on the membrane gets activated, and all the signaling cascades, and those can impinge on these different pathways. Only very few examples are shown here. For example, the activated tyrosine kinase can inhibit pyruvate kinase, one of the isoforms of the pyruvate kinase called M2, which preferentially channels the glucose metabolism to the pyruvate rather than allowing it to go into the TCS cycle. And similarly, PI3K/AKT pathway can enhance, positively influence glucose transporters, which enable increased influx of glucose into the cell. And the first enzyme, rate-limiting enzyme there is a hexokinase. It increases its activity, and another enzyme source of fructokinase. So all these activities are increased as a result of the AKT signaling and PI3K signaling, which you saw in the previous lecture. And what is shown, usually what is shown here in green is oncogenic proteins, and what is shown in red is the tumor suppressor proteins. So just an example, this is to oversimplification because here only you see one arrow, but P53 affects multitudes of these steps in this pathway. Similarly, AMT, LKB as well. So, and MYC is another oncogene which pushed metabolic processes by favoring or increasing glutaminolysis. So it, the cells, MYC enables the cells to utilize glutamine as a source of energy in addition to glucose. So that's one of the ways MYC is known to drive oncogenic process. So that's famous name in the metabolic process who discovered TCS cycle. Hans Krebs, who received the Nobel Prize back in 1953. Now the basic steps involved in the metabolic processes. First, glycolysis, and forms acetyl-CoA, and that acetyl-CoA is channeled to the Krebs cycle, and the Krebs cycle, as I mentioned a minute ago, takes some of those products, especially like NADH and NADPH, to the oxphos complexes where it generates an electron gradient, helps the final steps to produce ATP from ADP. So there are, overall you can say there are in general four steps involved in this whole process, and that is shown here. Glucose leads to pyruvate, pyruvate leads to acetyl groups enters the Krebs cycle, and in glycolysis itself there is a net production of 2 ATP, and in the Krebs cycle there is a net production of 2, and in the entire electron transport system, oxidative phosphorylation produces 32 ATP molecules. So this is the major site where most of the ATP is produced. Now, glycolysis, as the word implies, splitting of sugar breaks down glucose into two molecules of pyruvate, occurs in the cytoplasm, and there is an energy investment phase and energy payoff phase. Energy investment phase means some of these intermediate molecules need to be quote-unquote activated, which requires an ATP input. So ATP phosphorylates these proteins, and as a consequence, ADP is produced. So that's what is called the investment phase. And some of these steps generates ATP, and that's the energy payoff phase. So the net production of total whatever is the balance, that's what you saw in the previous slide, 2 ATP molecules from the glycolytic step, occurs whether or not oxygen is present. That's the particular nature of glycolysis, which you will see in the next few slides. Why is it important? Glycolysis harvests chemical energy by oxidizing glucose to pyruvic acid. The oxidation of glucose to pyruvic acid produces ATP and NADH, which is shown here. So some of this might be, appears repetitive, but the purpose is to reinforce the idea of what's going on in each of these processes. Again, 1 glucose, 2 ADP, and phosphate, and 2 NAD is needed for glycolysis, and the output is 2 pyruvate, 2 ATP, and 2 NADH. Then entering the mitochondria from the cytoplasm, the product of glycolysis, pyruvate, and pyruvate undergoes decarboxylation to produce acetyl-CoA in the presence of coenzyme A. And that's the major substrate for the TCA cycle or tricarboxylic acid cycle or Krebs cycle. And as I said, it is also the starting material for quite a few biosynthetic processes such as fatty acid synthesis. Now this is another way of looking at the TCA cycle. We were here in the previous slide, acetyl-CoA, and that enters into the citric acid cycle. And as you know, this is an oversimplified circle. There are quite more players in here. In some of the subsequent slides, you will see them. But just to show you here that 3-NADH is produced, and FADH2, the reduced form of FAD, and carbon dioxide is released here, and ADP, ATP is generated from ADP. And then comes the major part of the energy production in the cell, that's the OXPHOS complexes. So the OXPHOS complexes, basically, it lies at the inner membrane of the mitochondria. Mitochondria has an outer membrane and an inner membrane. And these complexes are lined up here, if you may hear. So that's this is the inner mitochondrial membrane here. And these complexes are lined up there. And then this is the inside the mitochondria in this area, for example, is called the matrix. And this part is called the inter mitochondrial membrane space. So these are two things which you need to remember here, matrix and the membrane space here. In other words, the space between two membranes. Why is it important? Here, when NADH and also FADH, which is not shown in this particular slide, they generate an electron gradient by pumping up protons. So basically, you can think of this as a sort of Niagara Falls, since we are close to that. So basically, you are generating a gradient. This part, the inner membrane space, is devoid of any hydrogen ions here, and it is to be pumped from this space to here. So each time it produces a higher gradient. And then, so you can imagine that the water is getting accumulated at the top of the falls, and in the very last step, it goes in the opposite direction. So there is a big change in the electrical gradient here, generated by the proton gradient. And here it is pumped up, and it is pumped down. And during that process, it generates a conformation change for the enzyme which generates ADP, ATP from ADP and a phosphate. So that's what is how it generates the ATP molecules here. And here, how it keeps the flow is that in this complex 3 here, this is named as complex 1, 2, 3, and the last one is the 4, where ATP is generated, whereas in all these ones are used for pumping out protons. So in this case, oxygen comes in, and along with the protons, the electrons, it forms water molecules. So this is why oxygen is necessary for the oxidative phosphorylation to generate ATP. Without oxygen, you would not have this flow. Because if it is prevented here, there are some drugs to prevent these various steps used experimentally, then the whole process will stop. So you have to keep this process going. That's what oxygen does. It combines with the hydrogen and produces water. And then a new set of NADH and along with the protons comes to take over the place and keep pumping the proton out, generate the gradient. So that's again the total calculation here, electron transport system 34, that's the highest which you saw here. This whole thing generates the highest number of ATP. So that's 34, and the citric acid cycle which you saw right before, that generates 2, and glycolysis as I mentioned 2, total 38. And out of the 38, there are 2 ATP needs to be used for transporting NADH to the mitochondria. That enzymatic process needs 2 ATP molecules. So you subtract that. So the net output of the whole glycolysis along with the TCA cycle, along with the oxidative phosphorylation, is 36 molecules of ATP. And these are all the how much energy it is. These are all you will know. You already know from your undergraduate studies, I hope. So, just to remind you that, so 34 to 36 molecules of ATP for every glucose molecule. So the efficiency is about 40%. The high energy ATP molecule stores 7.3 kilocalories. And now we turn up to what is happening in the normal tissue versus tumor tissue. How is cancer metabolism different from that of the normal what is happening in the normal cell? So in the normal tissues, in the presence of oxygen, there is no lactate production. For example, most of it, the energy is generated by oxidative phosphorylation and Krebs cycle. If oxygen is not present, then it is mostly glycolytic. That's why the end product is lactate. This happens sometimes in athletes, or even when any one of us exert ourselves too much. If you run too much or whatever physical exercise, then the muscles, the oxygen is depleted from the muscles, and then oxidative phosphorylation, glycolysis takes over oxidative phosphorylation. And that's why you get the pain because of the lactate production, etc. So that's just an example in the normal tissue. In the absence of oxygen, the example shown here is a liver tissue, but in the absence of oxygen, glycolysis happens. In the presence of oxygen, TCA cycle and oxidative phosphorylation are the processes to generate ATP. In the tumor tissue, whether oxygen is there or not, lactate production is happening. Lactate, in other words, glycolysis is preferred in general over TCA cycle and oxidative phosphorylation. Of course, in the presence of oxygen in normal tissues but even in the presence of oxygen here, still there is lactate production. Actually, this should be 1 plus and 1 minus. So in either way, I think the one is missing when the slide was made. Sorry for that. So you can mark it in one case, plus O2, minus O2. Okay. In either case, it is lactate production. So this process, this finding was years ago, back in early 1950s. German scientist Otto Warburg is the one who first observed this. Proposed this. Cancer, above all other diseases, has countless secondary causes, but even for cancer there is only one prime cause. Summarized in few words, the prime cause of cancer is the replacement of the respiration of oxygen in normal body cells by a fermentation of sugar, which is essentially what is glycolysis. So that's what he proposed. So the greatness of that observation is that not that the, all, whatever he said still remains exactly right today. Some of them are not, we know now that they are not exactly literally right. There are quite a few nuances to it. But what is most important is that he's the first one who proposed how metabolism could be important in cancer. So that's what the importance of Warburg hypothesis. Now, yes, as you go through the lecture, you would see that now it is cancer cells not just use glycolysis. They can use oxidative phosphorylation also, fatty acid metabolism also, to drive the process. But that's not the point here. He is the first one to suggest the metabolic difference between normal and cancer cells. observation that most cancer cells predominantly produce energy through high rate of glycolysis followed by lactic acid. So that's the Warburg hypothesis. And that diagram again to remind you. So the uncontrolled growth and division of cancer cell relies not only on the deregulation of cell proliferation but also on the reprogramming of cellular metabolism, including increased aerobic glycolysis. So. Now if you look at in little more detail what we saw in the previous slide, in the unicellular microorganisms, for example, in the presence of, when there is abundant nucleus, it leads to proliferative metabolism, and in that case, those organisms use mostly glycolysis as a means, and biomass instead of lactic acid in higher eukaryotes, most of them produces ethanol and quite a few other acids, acetic acid, ethanol and such like that. But it is the glycolytic process what's predominantly occurring here. In the absence of enough nutrients, or when the nutrients are scarce or starvation metabolism, then the sugar is the ATP is generated through the oxidative phosphorylation process here. Now in multicellular organisms, similar story. When nutrients are abundant and in presence of growth signal, proliferative metabolism occurs through glycolysis here. When there is no growth signal in most of our normal cells, that is why, like when cells are quiescent or differentiated cell metabolism, most of the ATP is generated through oxidative phosphorylation. Another way to look at it, in differentiated tissue, in presence of oxygen, glucose is converted to pyruvate, pyruvate is converted to lactate. Finally, in this case, for example, lactate is the final product. Here, lactate is not the final product. Part of the pyruvate, as you saw in the previous slides, gets into the mitochondria and undergoes Krebs cycle and oxidative phosphorylation. The final product would be being carbon dioxide. So here in the oxidative phosphorylation, total 36 molecules of ATP is produced, 36 moles of ATP is produced per glucose. And here, the same way, only the difference is that is the product is lactate, as you saw in the glycolytic process, and much less number of molecules of ATP is produced here in the anaerobic glycolysis process. Now, in the proliferating tissue and in the tumor tissue, it is predominantly what is happening here is that 85% of the cells uses glycolysis and only 5% oxidative phosphorylation and TCS cycle, ATP is produced here. So it's predominantly the preferred pathway is via lactate production or glycolysis in proliferating tissue as well as in tumor tissue. Now in the normal tissue, in the normal proliferating tissue, there are a lot of checks and balances as we saw in the previous lecture, and when some of those checks and balances are broken down in the cancer cells, that's why you get stuck in the glycolytic process. This is just an experimental Warburg's experiment those days back in Science 1956. It's real data. He took several types of cells and looks at the oxygen consumed per ml and what you need. For example, if you look at the QMO2, which means lactic acid produced aerobically. So here you can see some of the aggressive cancer cells, high malignant cancer cells, those values are high compared to the low malignant cells as well as the normal cells of young embryos here. So this is the special nature of cancer cells. Even in the presence of oxygen, glycolysis is preferred. Because this, we are not talking about highly strained muscles or anaerobic conditions or microorganisms growing in anaerobic condition. These are regular cells with plenty of oxygen available. Even then, they use the product is lactic acid. That's why it is very high lactic acid production, which means glycolysis is very high. These observations like these are the ones which led Warburg to hypothesize that one of the hallmark of cancer cell is glycolysis rather than oxidative phosphorylation for energy. Now, another way to experimentally show that the tumor cells consume a lot of glucose, and also that approach is used clinically to identify or to monitor tumor growth. So that is by using a molecule called 18F-fluorodeoxyglucose or FDG, and that's used for imaging. So what is this FDG glucose? It's a glucose analog with replacement of the oxygen in the C2 position with 18-fluorine. Though it behaves as glucose in many situations, there are some important differences that should be understood. Just as glucose, FDG is actively transported into the cell mediated by a group of structurally related glucose transport proteins, or GLUT. These are the transporters sitting on the membrane. Once intracellular, glucose and FDG are phosphorylated by hexokinase, as you saw the very first enzyme, as the first step. Normally, once phosphorylated, glucose continues along the glycolytic pathway for energy production. FDG, however, cannot enter glycolysis because the C2 position is replaced with the fluorine. It cannot go further down the chemical reactions. Once FDG, however, cannot enter glycolysis and become effectively trapped intracellularly as FDG6-phosphate. Tumor cells display increased number of glucose transporters, particularly GLUT1 and GLUT3, as well as higher levels of hexokinase isoforms types 1 and 2. Tumor cells are highly metabolically active and favor the more inefficient anaerobic pathway, adding to the already increased glucose demands. These combined mechanisms allow for tumor cells to uptake and retain higher levels of FDG when compared to normal tissues. So one thing to note is that FDG is not cancer specific because it will accumulate in areas with high levels of metabolism and glycolysis. Therefore, increased uptake can be expected in sites of hyperactivity such as muscular and nervous tissues, active inflammatory regions, if you have an infection or sarcoid or arthritis, etc., and tissue repair, etc. So this is FDG is used in clinic for monitoring tumors. So this is what you saw, what was explained in the previous slide. It is taken up just as glucose, and then the first step is the enzymatic step. It undergoes similar to the glucose molecules. But after that, it gets trapped. It cannot move forward. It accumulates. And that accumulation is a measure of how active the cell is in glycolysis process, because the transporter and the first enzyme is measure of how active glycolysis is here in these cells. And that's why in tumor cells, what you can, for example, you can see what is noted here as T, very intense signal here in one side of the lung, not on the other side. So this indicates the presence of tumor cells. But that has to be distinguished from other normal cells, because, for example, in kidney, where is used for the anything which you take has to be excreted through kidney and the urinary bladder. That's why you get some of those signals there too. So a clinician has to distinguish these two types of signals in determining how these tumor specificity or tumor how he can monitor, he or she can monitor the tumor growth. So this is before any treatment. This is after treatment with one of the inhibitors. In this particular case, I think it is that one of the tyrosine kinases, you familiar from previous lecture, in the one of the inhibitors, sunitinib. When that one drug is used, you can see that what the signal in the lung is essentially disappeared. Whereas the non-specific signal, because of the excretion part in the kidney and the urinary bladder, still remains. So now, what do we know beyond what Warburg proposed those days. So that's what we are going to look at here. Aerobic glycolysis is 100 times faster than oxidative phosphorylation in the mitochondria. Although oxidative phosphorylation is the most efficient way to produce ATP, because as you saw, 36 ATP versus 2 ATPs in glycolysis. However, cells have advantage if they use glycolysis because it is very fast compared to the mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation pathway. So cells can adapt pretty fast to their energy demand of highly proliferating cells. Increased glycolysis allows the diversion of glycolytic intermediates into various biosynthetic pathways. So this is another advantage of glycolysis. Some of the intermediary compounds in that process can be channeled to synthesize nucleic acids or fatty acids, things like that. I mean, it's not that you will see that mitochondrial pathways also can lead to those, but glycolysis is very efficient as it is faster. So these pathways, because when there is high demand for nucleic acid, extra nucleic acids and proteins, because the cells are dividing fast, so they need all these products immediately, very fast. That's one of the advantages of having high rate of glycolysis. Now, it facilitates the biosynthesis of macromolecules and organelles required for assembling new cells, ensures that cancer cells have a ready supply of building blocks needed for macromolecule synthesis. So basically what you see here is a schematic representation of glucose leading to pyruvate leading to acetyl-CoA, and lactate is one of the products. Similarly, glutamine is another raw material, as I mentioned previously, which can generate these products. And they, in addition to generating ATP, they can go into synthesizing amino acids through acetyl-CoA and glycerol into lipids and fatty acids, and through the ribose and nucleobase pathways, it can generate nucleic acids. So just as a schematic diagram to show that in addition to generating ATP, it can all these raw materials can lead through various pathways, leads to generation of raw materials needed for cellular growth. So in non-proliferating normal cells, glucose is used up mostly for ATP production and some for macromolecular synthesis, because the cells are dividing slowly. Whereas in the proliferating cells, glucose is used up both for ATP generation and for macromolecular synthesis, such as proteins and nucleic acids, lipids and carbohydrates. And the glucose and glutamine are the two sources of these pathways. As you can see here, only 10% of glucose is used here to generate ATP. The rest are used for generating macromolecules needed for the cell. Now, the possible drivers of altered metabolism. One of the hypotheses is that hypoxic conditions, when there is low oxygen, a decrease in ambient oxygen availability, there is persistent metabolism of glucose to lactate even in aerobic conditions. It's an adaptation to intermittent hypoxia in pre-malignant lesions. So there is, if the cancer cells adapt when there is not sufficient oxygen or hypoxia, but by increasing glycolytic rate. Upregulation of glycolysis leads to microenvironmental acidosis, because lactic acid is produced so that generates acidic conditions, and that is required for evolution of phenotype resistant to acid induced cell toxicity. So some of the advantages, acidic environment is advantageous to cancer cells to not only to proliferate but to invade and metastasize as well. Subsequent cell populations with upregulated glycolysis and acid resistance have a powerful growth advantage, which promotes unconstrained proliferation and invasion. Now, one of the major tumor suppressors you saw last lecture, just as an example of how some of the tumor suppressors can influence metabolism, P53. P53 can inhibit the glucose transporters. So in the previous slide, GLUT1, GLUT3, and GLUT4. All these enzymes can be inhibited by P53. And many other steps in the glycolytic pathways depicted here can be inhibited by P53 or influenced by P53. Some are inhibited, some are activated via this tumor suppressor. And it, not only that, within the mitochondria itself, it increases the enzymatic activity of enzyme called GLS2 or glutaminase. And this is an apoptosis inducing factor, and which is a component of complex 1. And the SCOTO, you'll see this again, which is a assembly factor required for assembling complex 3 of the oxidative phosphorylation. All these are regulated one way or the other by P53. I wouldn't have the time to go into detail in this lecture, and that's not the purpose of this lecture, to give you an example of one tumor suppressor, how it can impact various aspects of the glycolysis. This is another way of looking at it. You can see not only P53, many other signal transduction components or tumor suppressors and oncogenes can impinge on various components of the metabolism. Here you already saw these: glycolysis and lactate production. So some of these names are defined here, you can look at. But all these components in the various steps involved in metabolism are influenced by very many of these oncogenes and tumor suppressors. P53, as you saw, increases SCOTO. That's what this arrow here, for example, indicates. And that's listed here in a table also. PI3K, AKT, P53 is a tumor suppressor. These are oncogenes. This is another look at what P53 does within the mitochondria. As you saw, P53 can influence complex 1 of the mitophosphos. Yeah, it can also influence complex 2, complex 3. And via SCO2, another protein required for the assembly of complex 3, it can influence all these complexes. And some of the other components you already saw in the previous slide, GLS2. And this is the skeletal TCA cycle here, which is quite a few of these steps are also influenced by P53, which is not shown here for the sake of clarity and not get overcrowded in the slide. So this is one of the classic papers which showed that P53 can regulate mitochondrial respiration directly, back in 2006, few years ago, appeared in Science. So basically what that paper showed is that SCO2, which we already heard about, it is required, P53 transcriptionally activates SCO2. In other words, for SCO2 transcription, P53 is required. It binds to the promoter and activates the transcription of this gene, and it produces more protein, obviously, and that protein is required for the complete assembly of this complex here. If this protein is not in sufficient quantities, this complex is defective, and that will reduce the efficiency of the oxphos system and can lead to mitochondrial dysfunction. And since then, various other components of the oxidative phosphorylation has been shown to be regulated by tumor suppressors like P53 and oncogenes such as MYC, for example. So this is a famous observation by a famous scientist, Steve McKnight, back in 2010, a few years ago, not that far. So the idea here is that If regulatory state, transcription factors, signaling pathways, etc. is accepted to control metabolic state, as you saw in the previous slide here. All these are regulating these ones, right? We saw quite a few, there are quite a few examples like that. There are several observations published in that those areas. So what he's saying is that if that is accepted to control metabolic state, is it not also unconditionally certain that metabolic state will reciprocally control the regulatory state itself? So the whatever happening in the metabolism, can't they also influence those pathways in a reverse manner? Understanding this reciprocity and digging to the bottom of it is where the future lies. So that's what is one of the front lines in of contemporary research is in understanding how this two-way traffic is occurring between mitochondria or cell metabolism and nucleus, and mainly their cellular location is mitochondria and nucleus. So some of the examples are shown here. Mutation of metabolic genes in cancer. So this is quite a recent observation back in 2010, 2012, etc., as you can see from the references, not very old. So what these observations told us is exactly what you are talking about in this slide, that some of the components of the TCS cycle, for example, can the mutations have been observed in some of those in some types of cancers, and they can influence the growth of these tumors by influencing various pathways. So here it is not like proteins like P53 or MYC influencing the metabolic pathways, but here the metabolic components or pathways themselves influencing the other signaling pathways leading to cancer. So it one of the those is illustrated here. This particular enzyme, which is phosphoglycerate dehydrogenase or PGHDH, it is involved in converting or channeling phosphoglycerate to the phosphoglycerate pyruvate here. This is the enzyme catalyzes that step. Once this is overexpressed in the cells, what it does is it can lead to serine and glycine synthesis. Instead of going predominantly to this pathway in a normal cell, this can be diverted through the here. And another enzyme, PSHE1, from the glutamate, it can convert into alpha-ketoglutarate and can feed back into the TCS cycle as well. So here to note here is that some serine and glycine through multiple steps which are not shown here, it can lead to synthesis of the macromolecules such as proteins, lipids, DNA and RNA, which are really substrates for proliferation as I mentioned earlier. And glycine can lead to creatine and glutathione synthesis here, and those can work in against oxidation and influence redox balance and energy production as well. So one just high expression or higher amount of quantity of one enzyme, the consequences can be severe. Yet another example here, citrate to isocitrate and alpha-ketoglutarate. These are some of the steps in the TCS cycle if you remember your old biochemistry. And there are various enzymes involved here. The isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate is catalyzed by the dehydrogenase 1 or 2. And if in normal cells, alpha-ketoglutarate is the product, and that is involved in many regulation of various enzymes in the category of dioxygenase enzymes in the cell, which has important functions in the cell. Again, I don't have the time to go into the details of this. We'll show one example later on. In some cancer cells, that particular either IDH1 or 2 is mutated. So instead of going to here, what happens or going further into through the like TCA cycle, it gets converted into a compound called 2-hydroglutarate or 2-HG. This is an important metabolite which can influence many signaling pathways in the cell. So I'm going to show you one example in the next couple of slides. So this is yet another case situation where here is a TCA cycle. So what you are looking at was that here alpha-ketoglutarate and succinyl-CoA, the next product is succinate, and then the succinate dehydrogenase catalyzes the production of fumarate. Fumarate hydratase catalyzes the production of malate, etc. So any defects in any of these enzymes, for example, a mutation or a defect in the production of SDH can influence the cycling. And once the cycling is influenced, means the substrate is increased because there is no way to convert them into. So that's what the red arrows indicates here. So the cells have a way to alter their fate in this TCA cycle, which has its own consequences. So one of the consequences here is, I'll show you that as an example. This is a hypoxia-inducing factor. Why I'm showing you as an example, it is, as I told you in the last lecture, it is one of the hypoxic condition is one of the important aspects of cancer cells, especially the inside the tumor. The lack of sufficient oxygen leads to hypoxic condition, and that can lead to abnormal expression of certain genes which will generate proteins which are proliferative, including angiogenic factors which are required to generate new blood vessels. So in normal situation, what happens is that one of the factors in the hypoxia is HIF-1 alpha. That's a very highly regulated subunit of that hypoxia-inducible factor. So in the normopsia, when oxygen is normal level, what happens is that there is enzyme called proline hydroxylase, which hydroxylates some of the proline residues, proline amino acid in this protein. So as you can see, it is tagged with a proline or a hydroxylase. And this hydroxylated HIF-1 alpha can be recognized by a tumor suppressor protein called VHL. So the purpose, the job of this VHL in this case is that it complexes or binds to HIF-1 alpha and leads to degradation. In fact, this is the VHL in this case is a component of the degradation machinery here, protein degradation. So VHL as a tumor suppressor binds HIF-1 alpha and takes it to the degradation pathway. In other words, HIF-1 alpha is just eliminated because it is not needed when oxygen levels are normal. Now, in the case of if oxygen levels are not below the required level or what is called hypoxia, physiological stress, oxygen and nitrogen species, for example, if they are not in the right proportion, what happens? Or when growth factor stimulation, as you saw last week, EGFR activating, PI3K, AKT or mTOR activity, or mutations in this tumor suppressor, all these can lead to same outcome, which is HIF-1 accumulation, because there is no signal to degrade it as it happens here. So once it accumulates, it forms a complex with its partner HIF-1 beta, and HIF-1 and alpha and beta then travels to the nucleus from the cytoplasm, and that it binds to various genes which are known to regulate proliferative functions. For example, here several genes are known to upregulate glycolysis. Then some of them are involved in pH regulation. Some of them, as I mentioned, are regulating angiogenesis. Some of them are involved in regulating abnormal proliferation. Things of all those type of genes have the recognition motive for these complex. So those type of genes are upregulated, transcription is upregulated from these, and these type of proteins are produced which will drive the cancer cell. So that's the consequence of hypoxia. Now if you look at the previous diagram I was showing you here, that just put it in this corner here, when SDH or FH is defective, some of the substrate accumulate because they are not decarboxylated to the next product, right? So some of the products accumulated are citrate, isocitrate, fumarate, and succinate. When those products are in excess, what happens here? This is a normal pathway as you saw here, just a different way of depicting here. HIF-1 alpha in the normoxic situation gets hydroxylated, and VHL forms a complex with this. What I'm talking here is this diagram here. Okay, so hydroxylated, and hydroxylated gets ubiquitinated, and proteasomal machinery degrades the HIF. So normoxia that's how it inactivates HIF-1. Whereas in hypoxia, as you saw in the previous slide, this process is prevented, and therefore this pathway happens here, a different version of this diagram here. Same thing, it binds to the target genes and produces a lot of target mRNA synthesis increases and proteins. Now what happens if, so hypoxia and normoxia, which you already saw in the previous slide. So the purpose of this slide is to show, even irrespective of normoxia or hypoxia, if any of these enzymes are defective here, what would happen? These substrates will get accumulated and they will prevent this step, block this step. In other words, the hydroxylation, they will inhibit the prolyl hydroxylases here. Therefore, the hydroxylation doesn't happen. So this will remain active because it will, once it blocks the HIF-1 hydroxylase, this enzyme, then VHL, the normal route, complexing with VHL and degrading the HIF-1 alpha is blocked. The result is active HIF-1 alpha, and that will lead to the same consequences here as if it is hypoxia. So that is why it is called a pseudo-hypoxia. So in fact, the cells do not have an hypoxic situation, but it is mimicking because of this process here. Okay. So in other words, it is giving an incentive to the cells in the normal cancer cells, regular cancer cells, whether they are outside or inside the tumor, even though there is no physiological hypoxia, it is having, they generate a pseudo-hypoxia influencing their abnormal division. So that is one way how these metabolic products or substrates can influence the gene expression of the cancer cells, which is happening in the nucleus. Remember, these are all happening in the mitochondria, and this is happening in the cytoplasm. So interconnecting all these, you can it generates a pseudo hypoxia to drive cancer. Now another way metabolism influences gene expression is by epigenetic reprogramming by oncometabolites. So this is, for example, an oncometabolite, if you may, and as you saw here, this is another oncometabolite, as we already talked about, 2-HG. So this is another, some of these are familiar characters to you by now. This is another version of an abridged version, if you may, of the Krebs cycle. Just showing only the relevant characters here, succinate, fumarate, and malate. And this is the enzyme succinate dehydrogenase converts succinate to fumarate, and fumarate hydratase converts fumarate to malate. If there is a defect or a mutation in these enzymes, what would happen is that this is, you already saw the IDH2 mutation. And normally what happens is that if these enzymes are defective, The products are 2HG, which I showed you, succinate or fumarate. They, when they accumulate, they block a category of enzymes within the nucleus called the demethylases. So in the chromatin, I don't know whether you already had the lectures. I don't remember your lecture schedule, or you are going to have it. Did someone already talk to you about epigenetic formation or gene expression? No. Okay, so then one of the lectures you will be hearing that. So you will hear about chromatin, you will hear about methylation, acetylation, etc. So here, just I'm mentioning that here, methylation of chromatin in many cases is shuts off certain genes. So the job of these is that some of these substrates are to block the demethylases. So in the nucleus, there are methylases and demethylases. When the gene expression needs to be shut off, in many cases, those genes are methylated, and when they are demethylated, the genes chromatin becomes open and they can get activated. Several genes can get activated, and these are the enzymes which demethylates. One is called TET and another is called KDM. Those are, KDM means histone lysine demethylases. It is KDM. Another enzyme is TET. So these enzymes are necessary for demethylating the inactive chromatin to generate active chromatin to activate various genes needed. But when these products are accumulating in the mitochondria, they travel from the mitochondria to the cytoplasm to the nucleus and then block these demethylases. So these enzymes are blocked, therefore they remain in the inactive state, therefore influencing gene expression. So that can also lead to abnormal gene expression, which is again another recipe for cancer. So this is also sometimes this process you might see in some papers or when you read any research papers. This is also called retrograde signaling, because usually nucleus controls a lot of things, but here the mitochondria is influencing nuclear function. And this is some of the other examples which details, again, I don't have the time, but some of these modifications happening on the chromatin: methylation, phosphorylation, acetylation, ubiquitination, glycosylation, and all these can be influenced by metabolic products one way or the other. Now, another example I want to show you, mitochondria itself. We were talking about the metabolites or oncometabolites in the mitochondria generated in during the abnormal metabolic pathways in the mitochondria, but mitochondria itself can influence cancer. So this is a brand new information, as you can see, only a few months ago, published in Cell Reports. So here, what the authors have shown is that mitochondria is the driver of cancer. We always used to think that nucleus is the master of the cell, and that has a lot to do with cancer. Of course, it does, but here, one of the important things is that mitochondria is a driver of cancer. They did very elegant experiments putting different mitochondria into cells which have been, its original mitochondria has been removed, and all sorts of tricks. So the conclusion is that in a particular type of breast cancer called triple negative breast cancer, which is extremely aggressive and there is no treatment for these cancers at the moment, the cancer uses not glycolysis, as Warburg was suggesting. They consume fatty acids as a source of energy, and the fatty acids gets into the transported from the cytoplasm to the mitochondria, and they undergo what is called beta oxidation to generate acetyl-CoA. Remember, in the previous diagrams you saw acetyl-CoA being generated from glucose and then from pyruvate. Here, acetyl-CoA is generated by beta oxidation, and it is channeled to glycolysis, and as usual, the rest of the story is the same. NADH and FEDH2 are produced, which will propel the electron transport chain and produce ATP. Okay. Now comes the interesting puzzle here. So this is especially interesting because this person, the lab at Baylor College of Medicine, is a good friend and colleague of mine. So we kept talking over the phone when this whole project was evolving. So it is fun to learn some of the, or to know some of the detective work being done here. So this PSARC, I heard from me in the last lecture, that the very first oncogene ever discovered back in the Rockefeller University in New York years ago, decades ago. And the SARC is a cytoplasmic kinase, and when it gets phosphorylated, it becomes crazy. Crazy in the sense, it go and phosphorylate whole bunch of proteins, which promote abnormal proliferation. So it's a major oncogene, but nobody knew what's the connection between that and how it communicates between the cytoplasm and the nucleus and the mitochondria. So what these authors showed is that SARC can get into the mitochondria, and this excessive ATP generated can phosphorylate SARC, okay? And the phospho-SARC can feed back to increase the oxidative phosphorylation. So that's a propagating strategy here. And once it is phosphorylated, it can travel back to the cytoplasm and phosphorylated a whole bunch of proteins. So SARC generated from the nucleus through the cytoplasm to the mitochondria gets phosphorylated, and it increases phosphorylation itself by this feed-forward reaction here. And in addition, the phospho-SARC can phosphorylate a whole bunch of proteins. So the important thing to remember here for this particular metabolic perspective is that, first of all, it is not glucose here. It is fatty acid, what is the raw material used by these very aggressive cancer cells. But the end strategy is very same, increased energy production. Again, you can see it is not through glycolysis. It is through oxidative phosphorylation. Here is what Warburg went wrong. One can't say that, we can't blame him that, because he didn't know any of these things what we know about the cellular machinery. Nothing was known. So the credit goes to him. Even without rudimentary knowledge, he had that insight to propose that there is a shift in the metabolic pathway. But here the shift is not to glycolysis, but the same thing to fatty acid oxidation, and then leading to oxidative phosphorylation. Okay, and it is propelled by cancer. And the mitochondria is the driving force. All this is happening within the mitochondria. So this is mitochondria is regulating the nucleus here. And that's what all the data, obviously I'm not showing you or discussing with you, but their subsequent data shows that mitochondria is governing quite a bit of the nuclear function in this particular case. And how important this observation is, this happening in one corner in Texas, and similar, same conclusion was derived in another corner of USA back in San Francisco by another group. Fatty acid oxidation drives MYC overexpressing triple negative breast cancer. That was published at the same time in another famous journal, Nature Medicine. So if any of you are interested after the exam, or when some of you go back to the lab or excited about it, you can read some of these papers. It's really fascinating reading. You know, two groups simultaneously coming to the same conclusion. In one case, they are talking about SARC being activated by the fatty acid oxidative pathway, and in another case, it is MYC, another oncogene. Okay. Now, another interesting aspect in cellular metabolism, how important it is if you think about this situation, why don't elephants get cancer? Have you ever thought about it? Whales don't get cancer either. Why? Mouse get cancer, but whales and humans get cancer, but whales and elephants don't get cancer. Why? There's no really absolute answer to that. Still, there are a lot of unknowns. But one of the things is that the prevailing idea has been that when our cells divide fast, means when DNA replicates fast, there are chances of a lot of errors, which is true. And those errors are repaired, there is repair machinery. But just like any proofreading, sometimes things can go wrong. So then the damaged DNA is propagated to daughter cells, that's a prescription for cancer, right? If that's the only thing what is causing cancer here, then why elephants don't get cancer? Because if you talk about a small cell, it undergoes, if there is a mutation, it is perpetuated and ends up in cancer. But the number of cell divisions to generate an elephant is far more than the number of generation cell division needed to generate a mouse. Then why mouse get cancer and elephants don't get cancer? And for example, here they are showing an example of the embryo. The embryo to mouse is much shorter than an embryo to an elephant. And so the idea was in that when they looked at the body mass versus the energy used up, and if you do a log plot, here is how it looks. The mouse is all the way up here. The energy metabolism for smaller organisms are very high, and elephants, bigger organisms, are very low. Human beings will be somewhere in the middle. Okay, so this is based on this idea came that the metabolism may be a driving force to decide whether a particular organism is susceptible to cancer or not. High metabolic rate can lead to cancer incidence. Why? Because when the metabolism is high, you saw already some abnormalities can occur, and oxidative phosphorylation is needed for energy production, but one of the byproducts is free radicals, oxygen, which can go and damage DNA. So that's one of the prevailing interesting hypotheses out there. There is no absolute proof for this yet, but it's an interesting thought that, you know, why this could be not the only explanation. You need to think about an alternate explanation, and potentially you may have it in metabolism of these animals. And that can also link to another interesting aspect, that metabolism differs depending on the sleep habits of us. For example, highly metabolizing animals needs much more sleep. Mice needs 12 hours of sleep. That's why in the animal house here, they have the automatic light and dark cycles. 12 hours they need sleep. I mean, we need some, and an elephant needs how much? Can anybody guess how many hours they need to sleep?
Four.
Yeah, good. 4 hours. So, and we know how much we need. I mean, we don't mind sleeping 12 hours, but at least we need 6 or 7 hours to function optimally, right? So, highly metabolizing organisms need, when metabolic rate is high, they need longer sleep as well. So, connected to that is the idea that when you mess up with that situation, then metabolism gets changed, and that can lead to, for example, fatty acid production and lipid accumulation, which can lead to obesity. So there's a link between abnormal metabolism and our circadian rhythm. That's another aspect of interesting aspects of signaling we did not touch up at all, but that's another contemporarily very highly researched area, but I won't touch upon that. But the sleep hours and metabolism is very intimately interconnected. That's why in certain professions where the sleep hours are completely different, they have been shown to have high propensity to come down with cancer. Again, those are all correlations at the moment. There is no molecular exact, all the molecular dots are not connected yet, but there are some important dots out there. Now, comes to the therapeutic strategies. As we saw last lecture, we were looking at some of the potential strategies that are being used to correct abnormal signaling. Similarly, here, some of the strategies that could be used for correcting the abnormal metabolic feature of a cancer cell. So So before that, just to look at some of these are the hallmarks of cancer which you are familiar with you by now. And some of the arrows here, PI3K kinase, which you saw already, that can influence metabolism. At the same time, many of the metabolic activities you saw one way or the other now, the arrows go towards this. They can influence many of these cancer processes. And another process which can influence these processes is P53. You have the only thing there that there is a mistake they made in this paper, in this figure especially. You may want to correct it as mutant P53 rather than wild type. The mutant P53 will activate one of these enzymes in glycolysis, lead to increased glycolysis, and the mutant P53 will block this arrow. You can correct as a blocking bar instead of arrow. Here, mutant P53. So, score 2, as you saw in the previous slides, P53, normal P53 activates score 2. If it is mutant, it will not be activating score 2. If score 2 is not inactive, then it will be inhibitox force. So, that this arrow is right, but this arrow is wrong. It will be an inhibiting arrow, and this should be a mutant P53. But in any case, the purpose of this slide is to show that, again, the two-way traffic. So just only two examples are given here. PI3K and P53 can influence the metabolism, and various metabolic aspects can influence all these hallmarks of cancer. Another way to put it, genetic alterations, abnormal metabolic phenotype, and tumor microenvironment can generate abnormal phenotype. In turn, it can also influence tumor microenvironment. And bioenergetics, biosynthesis, and redox reactions and all. So the interconnectedness. Now, so exploiting that, there are several compounds out there being tried at various stages, inhibiting several of these steps in various pathways. This is just to show a glycolytic pathway. Different enzymes, different steps are being blocked by various agents noted here, and some of them are listed here. And this is another potential metabolic target for the treatment of cancer, not only glycolysis, various other pathways also. For example, here in this one, in their animal model, they use a drug called etoxomere. Then this drug will inhibit this enzyme. So when they inhibited this enzyme, the mice who were aggressively having cancer and tumors, all those tumors disappeared or reduced in size when they used the drug, because the fuel for this cancer was, a generation of fuel for this cancer was blocked. So similarly, there are many agents being used to block various agents. Okay. So now some of the various research tools being used to investigate all this, just to make you aware of it, DNA sequencing and epigenetic modifications, already I told you, and some the copy variation in the DNA, the genes can happen. These are all coming from the very relevant to the modern genomic analysis, which you will be hearing in some of the future lectures, or if not, some of your research studies down the road, and RNA analysis or transcriptome analysis, and post-translational modifications or PMT, we touched upon those two, and the proteins are relevant, protein levels are relevant, modifications are relevant, and the protein-protein interactions also are very important, and the metabolite levels in a cancer cells are important, and they are usually measured by using the physical techniques like HPLC and FPLC and stuff like that. And the metabolic flux like glycolysis, fatty acid, or oxphos, these are all measured by various types of by various biochemical assays and instruments, like one of the most modern instrument is called Seahorse. We have it at Roswell to measure this metabolic flux happening in the cancer cells. So just to some of the tools scientists are playing with to interrogate these tumor metabolism. Okay, so that's some of the references. Some of the what you might want or require reading to understand some of these aspects completely. So these are some of the very well written reviews, and these are down the road. If you are interested, you can read those also. And another thing I want to suggest for you already have the HeLa cell book already as required for your class, right? Mm-hmm. One book you may want to read, it's not required. I'm not going to ask any questions, but down the road, after all your exams are over, if anybody is excited about cancer mechanisms, is quite a famous, very well written book, The Emperor of All Maladies by Siddharth Mukherjee. It is a Pulitzer Prize winning author from Columbia University. He's a physician, scientist, and excellent author too. He was here at UB. He gave a distinguished speaker. I don't know anybody of you, some of your older students were here. A fantastic speaker as well. So that book is, you know, it starts a very historical perspective from all tumors to all therapeutic events. And it is coming from a physician's perspective with the knowledge of a real scientist as well. So that's the uniqueness of that book. And it's not boring. It's a thick book, but you wouldn't get bored to read it. So I think I would strongly recommend to read, especially those who are going either to medicine or to research. Okay. So I won't ask any questions from the book. Okay. Thank you.